Senate Committee on Health Services and Rural Health Policy will come to order. And welcome on this first day of an hour later.
Earlier.
Okay, we're going to have a couple of, we have two bills this morning. Neither one of them are very long, so we might be out of here early today. First public hearing, we'll open public hearing on Senate Bill 530. Would you give us a rundown, please?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 530 designates money from the General Fund to Department of Human Services for the purchase of protective equipment and supplies to respond to pandemic emergency, to provide and to train personnel, and for the purchase of influenza vaccines or antiviral drugs.
Okay, Senator Bocas, will you come up, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I am Brian Boquist, Senate District 12, which is five counties and six people in a sixth county in the Mid-Willamette Valley. I always want to get those six people in there because it's my Link Delane County, you know, in the south. So I feel like I have a lot of commonality with you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, you have a lot of commonality. You represent part of Lane County.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you'll recall, Senate Bill 530 actually started three sessions ago when the good Senator Verger and I were co-chairs in emergency preparedness, and you, Mr. Chair, were on that committee.
Yes.
And during that whole process, you know, we kind of identified, you know, the catastrophic type emergency preparedness that we needed to do. And through the good efforts of Senator Courtney, of course, it helps when you're the president of the Senate. We've made strides on the earthquake preparedness in terms of working on bridges and facilities and future constructions. And Dagami is working on that as well as tsunami preparation. Though we haven't done enough in the tsunami. I was just at the Dorchester conference this morning, and as I woke up on Saturday morning hearing the rain patter against the wall exactly one block from the beach, I thought to myself, if it starts shaking, I got to remember to get up and get out of here quickly. So we're making progress. The one area that we have not made many strides at, despite the hard work of DHS, even in these tough times, is in that area of the pandemic issue that we raised before. Our committee 4 years ago, and was raised for the committee 2 years ago. And so, as usual, I think Representative Tom Butler told me at one time, you know, legislation is this long-term process. Sometimes it might take four or five sessions before you get anywhere. So we're back again this year trying to remind the Ways and Means process downstairs that we still have issues in emergency preparedness, especially in the pandemic area. The challenge, you know, Mr. Chair, is that unlike the earthquake, which runs north and south, or the tsunami, which runs along the coast, we know exactly where that's going to happen in terms of planning purposes, so to speak, especially in the tsunami case. The unfortunate thing is we don't know when the bug's going to sneak across the border and in a pandemic, when a pandemic happens, and history tells us it will happen. We know that Nevada is farther ahead of us in the pandemic planning and has a stockpile of various drugs and preparation equipment, so on and so forth. And we even know down there in Utah in that corner that could sneak across to Idaho that they've done that. And we know Washington is about half the distance farther along than we are. The net result is, if a pandemic does happen, that we all know is we get to quarantine, and so we won't need that other bridge across the Columbia in Portland, and maybe we could use that money down in Coos Bay instead when it comes to the bridges. Just a suggestion, Mr. Chair. I know it's not in your area. But having said that, I would like the committee to listen to the testimony from the Department of Health and Human Services and give consideration of at least sending a message back downstairs to Ways and Means that we're not there yet. We are in lean times, but please remember, if we have available funding or we have available grant funding that we can get maybe under the Federal Emergency Stimulus Package or one of the future budgets that come out of Congress, or even when times get better in the state of Oregon, that we address the pandemic issue more than we've addressed it today. So with that, Mr. Chair, I will leave and go to my chair in Judiciary, because if I'm late, I'm generally in trouble.
You're open for questions.
I'm open for questions, Mr. Chair. But well, I must say, Mr. Chair, you or Senator Verger might be smarter than I on this particular issue.
Well, Senator Verger, do you have any questions or comments?
Well, I'd like to make a comment. I appreciate Senator Boquist bringing the bill. He was a fine co-chair. I thoroughly enjoyed our process with emergency management. And it grieves me that the Senate does not have an emergency management committee meeting. The House has one, but I do believe that it would be very valuable, particularly in the case of Senator Boquist, who has a lot of experience in the military, which really helped us a great deal in our process before. So I don't have any questions. We went through this quite thoroughly at the time, but I appreciate it staying before us. It needs to be on the radar screen without any doubt.
My questions will be, as we have testimony, the timeline. If we get the $100,000, you know, we can purchase some things sooner than later. The vaccine would be later, I suppose, although I don't know the life of vaccine. I don't know if we would purchase something just in case. I think it's a great idea to be prepared, though, because when it happens, we have to move very quickly. And the Department of Public Health and the local public health providers have to figure out how to get the vaccine. My suggestion is to work through schools. If it happens during that time period, is to get the kids before they go home. But this is a real serious problem, and it will happen at some point. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I may respond,
yes.
I mean, Dr. Lehman will be up here and talk to you, and we've worked over the last two sessions with Human Services in this, and you are quite correct. There are many items, you know, in staff preparation and gloves and distribution systems and so on and so forth we can do now without actually purchasing a vaccine and then address the vaccine issue later in the future. Now, we'd all like to say we have our full allotment that is subsidized by the federal government. The cost of that full allotment is about, I think, nine times what is in this bill right here, and we can't afford it. But we've got to keep it on the radar screen, and hopefully, and we can all say a little prayer every evening that by the time the economy returns and we have all of those things in place, that will be when the pandemic happens, when we're prepared. Sometimes, Mr. Chair, that doesn't happen, though. Thank you. Have a good day.
Okay. Thank you very much for being here. Dr. Lemon and Katie.
Good morning. I'm Katie King, the Government Relations Manager for the Public Health Division, the Department of Human Services. And I just want to say a few words of appreciation for Senator Boquist and Senator Verger and other members of this committee for their support of pandemic preparedness. We did work with then Representative Boquist last session to expand the scope of this bill so we could also use the funds for the purchase of personal protective equipment and for planning. So thank you very much.
And Chairman Morissette and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Richard Lehman. I am a preparedness medical epidemiologist with the Oregon Public Health Division, and I'm here to provide information on Senate Bill 530, which would appropriate state general funds to be used to respond to an influenza pandemic in three areas, to purchase personal protective equipment, to provide and train personnel, and to purchase influenza vaccines or antiviral medications. And I would just like to echo Katie's appreciation of the efforts of Senator Boquist in working with our previous public health director, Susan Allen, to expand the scope of what might be possible in terms of pandemic preparedness under this bill, so we appreciate his support. The impact of an influenza pandemic on the health of Oregonians will depend greatly on the characteristics of the influenza strain that causes the pandemic. Our pandemic influenza planning is based on scenarios developed by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services using data from past pandemics. And both moderate and severe pandemic scenarios would assume 35% or about 1.3 million of Oregon's population would become ill, and 50% of those would seek medical care. The number of deaths might vary by tenfold depending on the scenario, and it could range from 2,600 to 26,000 people. Personal protective equipment should be used as one component of a comprehensive worker protection plan, which is the responsibility of employers. The Public Health Division works with OSHA to provide technical assistance to both local health departments and other partners in worker protection issues. 27 local health departments and 7 tribes have purchased personal protective equipment with federal preparedness funds in 2008. When used for treatment of seasonal influenza, antiviral medications can reduce the duration and severity of illness. However, influenza viruses can develop resistance to antiviral drugs, and one of the currently circulating seasonal influenza strains has antiviral drug resistance that has been noted. It's impossible to predict exactly the efficacy of antiviral medications against a future strain of pandemic influenza, so we don't know for sure what the value of antiviral medications would be against a pandemic in the future. In addition, the shelf life of these drugs is limited, and if they're not used before they expire, they'd have to be discarded. We at the Health Division encourage annual vaccination for seasonal influenza because it's an effective way to prevent infection. However, as Senator Morissette pointed out, at the start of an influenza pandemic, vaccine would not be available for the new pandemic strain, and it would take 5 to 6 months to develop vaccine once that strain was identified and classified. Training of personnel and planning for early targeted use of non-pharmaceutical community-based mitigation measures will be very important in controlling an influenza pandemic. Such measures include social distancing, and I can talk about that if folks have questions, to control disease spread. And these are important strategies that may actually reduce the incidence of disease by up to 50%, according to CDC predictions. Multiple partners across many disciplines will have to be engaged and trained to effectively prepare for and respond to an influenza pandemic. Coordination of these efforts with our public and private partners is imperative for an effective response. So in summary, Senate Bill 530 has 3 provisions addressing preparedness and response to an influenza pandemic. DHS is neutral on the policy of purchase of equipment and supplies. Due to the cost and uncertain efficacy, DHS does not support stockpiling of additional antiviral medications at this time. DHS supports training and planning with public and private partners around community-based mitigation measures. However, there will be a fiscal impact to the bill, which is not included in the governor's budget. So I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Okay. Yes, Senator Virgil.
I guess I need a little clarification on your neutrality. I would presume that that does not mean you are opposed to building up the equipment, in other words, syringes, gloves, whatever would be needed, because those are they'd have a long shelf life, so maybe you need to clarify for me.
Mm-hmm.
You're neutral on the medications, but what about the equipment?
Well, and actually, Senator Morissette and Senator Verger, to clarify, we do not support purchase of additional antiviral medications at this time, in part because we have not been able to arrange for shelf life extension of this medication. And we think at this point, as we consider the alternatives and where we might put available resources, we don't feel that additional antivirals at this point is where we would put put these resources. There is certainly a role, as you say, for personal protective equipment. We have made purchases through federal funds in that area and have worked with local partners in order to make sure that they have availability. There have been issues that some of our partners have expressed around storage issues in terms of what the optimal amount of personal protective equipment would be so that they have an adequate supply and so that they also have adequate storage space for these.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Excuse me. Thank you.
Senator Kepler.
I need a little bit of clarification on the use of the $100,000. You mentioned the need for training for various partners. Is this how much money is needed for that? Doesn't appear to me that $100,000 is going to do much training if we're talking about statewide training, implementation of a plan, et cetera.
So, Senator Morissette and Senator Telfer, my answer is we do what we can with the funds that we have available, and we have additional sources that are available through our federal grants that allow us to pursue training and allow us to work with our partners. This would potentially allow us to do that much more in terms of preparation and to do so in as timely a fashion as possible.
Follow up?
Yes.
So what you're saying is $100,000 at this point is sufficient to do what we need to do in this state?
Well, Senator Morissette and Senator Telfer, again, we have funding that is available through the federal government, and my answer is no, we will not have complete preparedness for pandemic influenza based on this $100,000.
Would we ever have complete
preparedness? And certainly, Senator Morissette, that is an issue, and what we can do is prepare as best we can.
Okay, then what are we lacking currently in preparedness?
Well, Senator Morissette, if we find the ways, certainly it would be good if indeed thousands of people are getting sick, it would be good for us to be able to provide them with medication that would help them lessen the length of their illness and lessen its severity. But in public health, we're pretty interested in prevention. And if we can find the ways to do things in the early stages of a pandemic so that we can actually prevent people from getting ill, that is what's desirable. And that is where we need additional efforts in planning and in working with our schools, working with our organizations around the state so that we can take steps to prevent exposures to illness among people who are already ill. And if we do that early, we can actually decrease the speed with which people become ill. And if many, many people become ill very quickly, the total number of people ill at one time is very high, and that puts a tremendous burden on our healthcare system. If we can find ways through these mitigation efforts and social distancing efforts, for instance, one thing that we're doing in DHS is we're looking into ways that we can work potentially from home, or that we can work in smaller groups so that you don't have to bring a whole bunch of people together at a time when potentially someone there may be in the early stages of influenza, and in that way we can protect our people and protect our ability to do the critical things that we need to do. So that's one example.
Given in light of what we're already doing, what are the compelling reasons, if any, that we need this $100,000 this biennium?
We will be continuing to work on pandemic influenza planning, and we will do that because it is important. The $100,000, if we can put it toward people who can help us to further our planning efforts more quickly, we will just be further ahead of the game. But I would say that, candidly, this is not a make-or-break situation, the funding in this bill. However, I believe that by using that, we have our plans, and we can move our plans forward that much more quickly.
Senator Cruz.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Several points here. I suppose the first one that's frustrating is the fact that agencies are still having to respond to the governor's budget, which isn't based on anything real. through no fault of anybody's, it's just that October was a different critter than we have now. I guess, Mr. Chair, the issue, the $100,000 doesn't solve all the problems. However, you know, as we continue to do planning, historically we plan for every scenario in the world except the one that happens. And just because you never know what the variables are going to be. Section 1 of the bill gives the department a list of options, and I think that's appropriate because, quite honestly, the next pandemic we face may not be influenza. There are other pandemic situations out there. So I think, you know, Senator Verger's been involved for several years in emergency preparedness, and I just think $100,000 doesn't make or break. I know we don't have the reports to move the bill yet today, but I think for $100,000 to show the fact that we are still concerned and interested and supportive of moving ahead with our ability to plan for whatever the next major scenario is, I think is important. Wasn't a question.
Yeah. Thank you, sir.
Other comments, questions? Well, I guess I'm wondering what kind of money are we getting from the feds? How much do we receive? Is this? And then secondly, if there is a pandemic, the governor could declare an emergency and money could immediately be put into the program. I imagine that's what we would do as we identified, you know, waiting for 6 months for the vaccine to come out. That's the other problem. Are we accumulating the materials that we need that are mentioned in this bill? The optimum storage, you know, what are people going to do with all that stuff if we buy everything that we might need for a pandemic and it doesn't happen for 20 years? Is that still, even the rubber gloves, will they disintegrate? There are just a lot of things, and I particularly, what are the feds doing? CDC, are they the ones putting money into this?
So, Senator Morissette, funding is received from CDC, and we also get funding that comes in part through the Department of Homeland Security that goes to our colleagues in emergency preparedness. So that's not coming directly to public health, but we work with our colleagues in OEM on issues such as this as well. And in answer to your question and in answer to Senator Cruz's comment, certainly some of the things that we may purchase have limited shelf lives, and that certainly is an issue. And certainly some of the planning that we do that is specific to pandemic flu has application in dealing with other illnesses that may come upon us. And so there are certain things that we can do. There are certain things that we can arrange for where we figure out what optimal amounts of personal protective equipment are, and we make sure that those are available to folks, and that there are various ways to do that. That may be having a large stockpile here in Oregon. That may be working with vendor-managed inventory or folks who we can arrange to purchase certain things. not right now, but in advance of when they would be needed, so that we can put those to use and we would have them available to us. So there are a number of approaches that we can use in order to be prepared to respond, and we don't necessarily have to we may find that there are investments that we make in training and in planning that will have benefits beyond mere purchase of things that, as you say, may have a finite shelf life.
Senator Morissette, you had also spoken to the issue of federal funding,
mm-hmm.
and I don't have the exact amount in my head right now, but one thing that I do know is that funding over the last few years has been declining as much as 20% at the federal level, and that's of concern to us. There was funding for preparedness in the House version of the stimulus bill. However, in the final negotiations, that was dropped off.
Interesting. Senator Bridger.
What assurances do we have in case of a Western region pandemic or a national pandemic that Oregon will be able to get your fair share mm-hmm. of the antiviral medication? Is it going to depend on who has the money? Is it going to depend on what percentage of people within your state are ill? That worries me with Oregon being a small state. So what assurances does the department have to the public that they would be protected in case of a pandemic?
Senator Morissette and Senator Verger, Oregon has a stockpile of 544,000 courses of antiviral medication, which is made up in part of medication that was purchased by the federal government and set aside for Oregon, and it's made up in part of medication that Oregon actually chose to purchase, and that was in the neighborhood of 13,000 courses of medication. And also in Oregon, a number of organizations have purchased antiviral medications that they can use in their preparedness, their influenza preparedness efforts, pandemic preparedness efforts, and that amounts to an additional 13,000 doses. 13,000 courses, excuse me. So in total, we have 544,000 courses of medication, and that is enough to cover about 18% of the population. And we do have assurances that because each state has been apportioned a certain amount by the federal government, that we would receive those.
Interesting. They would go to health providers, first of all?
They would, so Senator Morissette, they would first arrive in the state from the federal strategic national stockpile, and then they would be distributed according to plans, so they would not go directly to pharmacies or to healthcare providers.
Okay. Well, I guess those are things. First of all, that antiviral substance doesn't last forever. So, are they constantly renewing it before we receive it, or is it stockpiled somewhere else?
Correct. And Senator Morissette, the federal government does have a stockpile shelf life extension program.
Okay. Okay. Part of the plan would have to, I think, and maybe this is where we need to think about money to do it, maybe we already have some contingency plans. How do we, who are the people who would be the frontline providers? They, it seems to me, would be have to receive the vaccine first to, in order not to be spreading it while they're, and that does not address the strain that we're talking that may be in existence at the time. So what is the effectiveness of that antiviral in terms of a new strain of flu, avian or whatever?
So, Senator Morissette, we, as mentioned, because we do not know for sure what strain or what variety of influenza might become a pandemic strain, that is, yeah, one to which folks do not have any resistance, we cannot know absolutely for certain that that new strain will be one that is susceptible to the antiviral medications. At the same time, we know that the antivirals are effective against the bulk of influenza A that affects humans that we have seen recently, although as I mentioned, there is some resistance in some of the strains of influenza that are currently circulating in the world. I think your question was, how do you protect folks on the front line, folks who are actually out there working? We need to make certain assumptions, and one assumption that we make in using antiviral medications is that they will be effective, and they will be able to control a pandemic strain that may come down the line. We don't know that absolutely for sure, and that's why we need to take other steps, and that's where personal protective equipment is very important, and where we can perhaps help people who are working on the front line to avoid infection. And those methods have been very effective. They were effective against SARS. As long as we know what we're up against, we seem to be fairly effective at helping to protect people.
Worst case scenario, terrorism and smallpox.
So, Senator Morissette, with regard to smallpox, that is also spread by airborne droplets from folks who are infected. We do have a vaccine already, which is effective against that. We have not been using that broadly at this point, but we do have public health professionals who have gone ahead and prepared by going ahead and being revaccinated, and I am one of those. So that would make me immune unless someone has been fooling with the smallpox virus, I guess. And we actually were very effective once we learned how to do it. Once again, once we learned what we needed to do, we were very effective in controlling smallpox and eradicating it. We could do it again.
Well, if it was a terrorist attack, that would have a real impact unless we were ready. Senator Montesanto.
Tell me if we still have a registry. I remember as a public health nurse having to register or prove that I had a smallpox vaccine, and then it was, I believe, public health wanted to know which providers had the vaccine so it would have possibly immunity. And I'm wondering if that is kept up to date. This was many years ago.
And Senator Morissette and Senator Anderson, the answer to that question is I don't believe that we do have a statewide registry along those lines. However, we are aware of folks within state and local public health who have been vaccinated and who could be involved in response.
Okay. Yes, Senator Reeder.
I just wonder, in the point of public education, if the department couldn't consider the 90 legislators that send out regular communications to their public. You would have thousands of people in Oregon. For instance, Senator Cruz sends out a letter weekly I don't send one that often, but I send one twice a month. Other people send, many people send one once a month. But still in all, the email addresses, cumulative, within the 90 members of the legislature would reach quite a number of people on a very personal basis about the prevention aspect that you're interested in. So I would just offer that to you as a suggestion.
All right. Well, Senator Morissette and Senator Verger, thank you very much for that comment.
Okay. Other comments? Okay. Thank you very much. That was...
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Others wishing to comment on this issue? Okay. Well, I guess we're waiting for... What are we waiting for?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, we're waiting for the fiscal.
Well, the fiscal is going to be $100,000, right?
Right, but we haven't received...
Well... should we do something with this bill, or should we just wait until we... It's too late.
Until we get the
discussion.
Until we get the statement that says what the bill says, yeah. We better wait.
Yeah. Okay. Those are the rules.
Those are the rules. We can always just send it the Ways and Means to start with, but that's okay. Okay, we will wait. We will wait. And hope that we have time. Okay, with that, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 530, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 531.
Mr. Chair, members of...
Oh, 541, I'm sorry.
341.
341.
Real
close.
That time change thing.
Wow, that time
only 200 off. That's not bad.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 341 requires Department of Human Services to provide home and community-based care to seniors and persons with disabilities through savings from nursing homes.
Okay. Nicole, would you come up, please?
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nicole Armstrong. I'm here on behalf of O4AD, the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities, and we provide long-term care services through eligibility, through OPI, through a number of things to over 90% of all seniors and people with disabilities receiving state-funded services. I wanted to thank you for listening to Senate Bill 341. Unfortunately, the bill, as it came out of Legislative Council, is not exactly what we were intending, so if you'll indulge me to speak to what the goal was. It traditionally, when we are in the rebalance, Seniors and People with Disabilities Division of the Department of Human Services often realizes savings from the utilization of home and community-based care or from the caseload savings through running a very efficient system, and we often lose those dollars in the rebalance to other parts of the department or often to the rest of the general fund. In the origins of ORS 410, the intent there is to be able to reinvest those kinds of savings back into the system of long-term care. If we were able to do that, certainly that would allow us to be able to do more, to be able to keep seniors and people with disabilities in their own homes and in their own communities, but those dollars continue to move off into other places. At the moment, we have a request into legislative fiscal from Representative Boone on the House side to look at what came out of Legislative Council and see what would need to be changed to actually get at that. So we are not actually going after nursing home allocations. It's just that's the language that was in statute that Legislative Council attacked first. So apologize that it's not exactly what we were intending, but that is the goal that we were trying to get to with this bill.
Okay. Questions? We may have questions after we hear other testimony. So
absolutely.
Just... be available. Okay, Rob Johnson, Jim Willis, Dave Fiscom, and then we will hear from James Taves after that, and maybe Nicole will come back. Okay, Rob.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Rob Johnson, and I'm here representing the Oregon Healthcare Association. We are a nonprofit trade association that represents just over 550 licensed long-term care facility members, including nursing homes, assisted living facilities, and residential care facilities, and licensed in-home care agencies. I should also mention that our membership includes just almost 350 of the facilities, I think, that the this bill intends to affect, and that would be our assisted living and residential care members. We have always and will always be supportive of bolstering Oregon's community-based long-term care system, but with that said, we have a few concerns about the way that Senate Bill 341 is currently drafted. First of all, we're not sure that the bill actually requires the state to do anything because of the very vague nature of the language in the bill. There's a potentially very broad interpretation of several of the key terms in the bill, which I'll address in a minute, but we're not sure that because of the broad nature of the language that it actually requires the state to do anything. Our first sort of concern about the specific language is what is meant by savings is never defined in the bill. Are we talking about total fund savings? Are we talking about general fund savings? Does it mean savings as a result of savings to the general fund as a result of provider taxes that are paid by nursing facilities? Does it include savings as a result of federal match, which is especially concerning considering the fact that in the federal stimulus package there's an increased availability of federal funds for nursing facility services? How are the savings calculated, which is never mentioned in the bill? And beyond that, I think when you consider the increased availability of federal match as a result of the federal stimulus package, I think it's important to consider that nursing facility services are as cost-effective as they have ever been. Really, the state general fund, I think, is funding about 15 to 20 cents on the dollar for nursing facility services, with the rest being paid for by provider taxes and federal funds. The bill also does not address who tracks the savings, which you would assume would be the Department of Human Services, which is going to cost some money in an FTE to be able to do that. I think James Tate from the department can speak to that more fully. And we haven't seen a fiscal on the bill, so we're not sure exactly what that cost would be. These are just some of the concerns that we have about the bill, and I think Director Willis and Mr. Fiskum will also address some similar questions as they relate to specific facilities in Oregon, but I'd just like to close by saying that, as I said before, we have always and will always be in support of bolstering Oregon's community-based long-term care services, but I think that it's OHCA's position that we need to make those investments across the spectrum of services and not in favor of one part of the spectrum at the expense of another. So with that, I'll conclude my testimony, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Questions? Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, good morning. I'm pleased to join my friend Mr. Johnson at your witness table. For the record, Dave Fiskum here representing Providence Health System. In addition to the seven hospitals we operate around the state, as well as a major health insurer, we also operate Providence Center for the Medically Fragile Children in Portland, Providence Benedictine in Mount Angel, and a number of other nursing facility beds in other parts of the state. I'm not sure what the intent is based on the words of Senate Bill 341. If it is to support community-based programs, we concur with that. Mr. Johnson has well stated that, and we are supporters of community-based programs when those are appropriate placements for individuals. But I guess I would say that if that comes at the expense of support for nursing facilities when those are the best placements, that raises concerns in our mind. Twofold, the definition of savings in nursing home services allocations is, based on the language in the bill, to us unclear and does not allow us to understand the potential impact of this bill on our nursing facilities that we operate in several parts of the state. Second concern is that the language could have, I didn't say would have, could have the potential to divert or reduce current nursing home funding for use in community-based settings, even when that might, such community-based settings might not be the best placement for a child or an adult. I hearken back in my mind to discussions we've had in this legislative session over the last few years about Providence Child Center for the Medically Fragile. A facility in Portland that I know some of you have toured, and you're welcome to tour that, but you would, I think, see that in that case of that facility, the only pediatric nursing home, if that phrase works in this state, whose beds are fully devoted to that population, those individuals there have really no other choice but to be there. Their families agree with that. Their families, in fact, are our best advocates for the adequate funding for that facility in Portland. That said, Providence is very supportive of increased funding for community-based care. We've worked with Representative Gelser and others for a number of years to achieve that end, but we're concerned that funding for community-based placements, if we don't look at that on a statewide basis, could in fact come at the expense of long-term care funding for nursing facilities, including the ones we operate. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll be happy to answer questions if they have any, but for the moment, I'll yield to Mr. Willis.
Questions. Okay. Mr. Willis.
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Willis. I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. Simply put, we are in favor of home and community-based care for veterans and others where appropriate. However, we do not support funding this type of care at the expense of another type of necessary care, in this case, skilled nursing homes or skilled nursing care for veterans. According to a census conducted by the federal VA, Oregon is in need of 800 skilled nursing beds for veterans. We currently have 151 skilled nursing beds at the Oregon Veterans Home in the Dalles. That leaves Oregon veterans about 650 beds short of skilled nursing. These are beds that cannot be replaced by home or community-based care. Our concern with Senate Bill 341 is the potential for the state to set a policy that rewards home and community-based care at the expense of skilled nursing care. We cannot support such a policy for Oregon veterans in need of skilled nursing. We believe Oregon's policy should be appropriate care for each Oregonian delivered by the most appropriate means. For some Oregonians, home and community-based care is the most appropriate care. But for some, nursing facilities such as the Oregon Veterans Home is the appropriate way to care for them. We believe both types of care are necessary and should be equally considered. If the state sets a policy to support home and community-based care at the expense of skilled nursing, such a policy could have dire consequence for the Oregon Veterans Home and the planned second Veterans Home. Today, 39% of our residents at the home pay through Medicare and Medicaid, or Medicaid. If DHS were to find savings in the nursing home allocations by not allocating this money to our veterans for skilled nursing, the Oregon Veterans Home would suffer significantly, and the department would have to determine whether a second Veterans Home would be viable under this type of policy. This is not in the interest of Oregon veterans who are in need of skilled nursing care. And the questions that I would have would be, would this preclude an increase in funding to nursing facilities in the future? Does the reallocation of, quote, savings, end quote, mean that if nursing facilities funding is cut, that those cuts would then be savings and not restored? The bill says that the alternative to nursing home care is to be least costly and least restrictive. What exactly does this mean in relation to the most appropriate setting for the patient or the resident? According to information in Senate Bill 548, the Medicaid long-term case load is expected to grow from 27,000 currently to 44,000 by 2030. What will happen to these Oregonians in need of nursing home care under Senate Bill 341? If the intent of Senate Bill 341 is to promote home and community-based care without degrading our current skilled nursing care, we do not oppose this bill. However, if the intent is to set a state policy focused on home and community-based care at the expense of skilled nursing, we cannot support this bill and must side with our veterans who need and will need skilled nursing in the future. Thank you for your consideration. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Good. Questions? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Go ahead. James. James Staves, would you come up, please? Nicole, would you come up and sit in the front row in case we need to get back to you? I want to know what the intent of this bill is.
You're the sponsor. You're supposed to know.
I know. I want them to talk about that, the intent. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, James Taze from the Department of Human Services Senior and Disabilities Program. Having heard already, Nicole is indicating that the language will probably change, so I'm not quite sure what parts of the bill to speak to, but let me sort of take it to a different level for just a second. Nursing home utilization in Oregon has declined continuously over a 20-year period. And as some members of this committee are very aware, that trend not only stopped but bottomed out and started to creep up within the last several years. And actually, in terms of savings, we have not had savings in the nursing home caseload. And I use the word savings in terms of caseload, the numbers of people actually utilizing nursing home beds. And that, as this members of this committee and several of you are very aware, was a matter of great concern because at the same time we saw a decline in Medicaid capacity in our entire community-based care system, in the in-home program, assisted living, foster care. And it was largely that which some of you championed during the supplemental session that had us do a $260 across-the-board increase for all of our community-based care system to try to halt that spiral and to reverse it. And actually, I'm pleased to announce, we've just looked at our caseload numbers now for the spring forecast and with the latest actuals from fall, and the trend actually has reversed. We've seen for the first time now in about 4 years an increase in our in-home program, assisted living, and foster care. And actually, we're very, very excited about that, and that's exactly the intent that I think you all had and that we had in advocating for a better way of funding our Medicaid capacity in our community-based care system. As all of you know, we were losing a large number of opportunities there because of the increases in the private pay market, and we will continue to struggle with that for years to come as the boomers retire and eventually need long-term care, because in the long-term care system, we purchase, the state purchases as part of the Medicaid program, a portion of that capacity, and the rest is private pay, and our Medicaid rates had never kept up with the private pay rate. So I think the actions we took earlier this year or earlier last year has really helped to stabilize that. The caseloads in the future we know will expand across the board, and we probably will see nursing home utilization increase over time, not decrease. But for us, the issue probably is what percentage of the population eventually will need nursing care. Our hope is not to expand or build more nursing capacity, but to be able to maintain probably the capacity we have with some puts and takes to that. But in the future, as a population grows, one can expect that that our overall capacity in all areas of care will probably increase. But having said that, I think Oregon is still very committed to keeping a balance, and the vast majority of our people served at higher acuity levels than other states to maintain that on the community-based side of the spectrum. The issue of that Nicole brought up, which I think was part of the intent of the bill, is the department recasts its budget about every 6 months. It's formally now known as the rebalance process. Obviously, we build our budget about a year before you even come into session, so often we're projecting 3 years into the future. And even when the economy is relatively stable, being able to predict what those caseloads will look like 3 years out is very, very difficult. So throughout the biennium, we rebalance the budget. And then across the entire department, all its divisions, all the caseloads are examined very closely in terms of which ones are going up, which ones are going down. And then it's both the expectation of the executive branch and the legislative branch that the department then rebalances that budget before we come back to the legislature. I know that's been the source of a lot of concern from some of our stakeholders who have seen savings over the years in the senior area being used broadly in other parts of the department to rebalance all of our caseloads. But over time, that's going to change. The senior and disability caseloads are going to climb and climb steadily. So to assume that there will be savings that we can divert to other uses, I think will rapidly disappear as the entire population doubles in the next 20 years. So not knowing, again, exactly what this bill will look like after the amendments come out, the whole issue of rebalancing around caseloads is a very sensitive issue for the legislature and the executive branch in terms of how we manage this budget. So with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? The intent of the bill basically is to keep the money within the senior programs. Now, whether or not it's to the detriment of the nursing homes, I would not want it to be to the detriment of the nursing homes. And I, you know, your closing statement is that it would, the overall inflexibility, it would reduce the department's budgetary flexibility would be, you know, could be a detriment. Nicole, could you come up, please? And I guess that's not the intent of this bill, and I would not want us to pursue a bill that would indeed, you know, be a detriment to the nursing home industry. And maybe so I will again ask Nicole to talk a little bit about the amendments. Where are we going with this?
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, as I mentioned earlier, we're waiting for information from legislative fiscal to see where the bill went off center, because it's absolutely not our intention to be to the detriment of the nursing facility industry. We believe that that is absolutely an appropriate care setting for a number of our seniors and people with disabilities, and we support that very strongly. We were trying to get at a bit of this rebalance question, but also recognize that the bill does not do that. So we are working with them to figure out if that's possible and how it does it. This is simply just what came out first from Legislative Council.
The concern has been, it's almost a cliche that, you know, the SPD is a donor agency. We give money, you know, we do a rebalance, we save money, you save money, or money is saved, I should say, and that money could then go to on any number of programs within DHS. And what we attempted to do under 1061 is to keep that money within the agency so you could increase the payments to the community-based, not to the detriment of the nursing homes, but the fact that we wanted to have a better balance throughout our entire system, which you've just stated has been successful. But as we know, all segments are going to grow, and you know, the veterans nursing home facility, I think that's a compelling argument not to in any way shortchange that segment. So I think what we're trying to do is we're trying to do good. But we will get some amendments, and we'll see what happens. And if we can somehow keep the money within the agency, within your agency, and not being, you know, that would be the number one priority, to put money into, you know, any savings that occur in services provided, to keep the money in that area. So with that, any other questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Yeah, I think it's a dilemma, and you saw what a problem we had in balancing the budget for the 07-09, and there was interest taken from other accounts and put into the general fund just because we didn't have the revenues. Mm-hmm. So, you know, anything that really restricts the flexibility of the legislature to try to balance, and I think the 09-11 is going to be even a worse case scenario than what we saw in 07-09. Just a comment.
Okay.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
I just find interesting. Current law basically says that if there are savings, they may be reallocated, but within service area and under Title 19 and OPI. But it doesn't say they can't go anywhere else, and I think that's the problem. Yeah. It's not necessarily we're going, and I have a problem with where it says shall use all savings. I don't think that's the intention here. So I guess if we were going to go forward with this, it'd be nice that the cluster didn't lose their dollars to some other thing. And I know that's problematic, but. But there's already a suggestion in law that the money stay within the service area and to specific programs, but that doesn't happen. So,
okay, good. Thank you very much. Others wishing to testify on Senate Bill 341? Seeing no others, we will close the public hearing. Other business before the committee? Seeing none, we will adjourn.
You're all fine.